Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. A cultural celebration of inclusion? The question of who is permitted entrance to the Olympic Dream is posed by Dr. Leanne Petherick of the School of Human Kinetics and Recreation at Memorial University of Newfoundland.
As spectators prepare to watch the Vancouver 2010 Games, thousands of athletes, coaches, training staff, and volunteers will have amassed countless hours in the pursuit of excellence. We may rearrange our schedules to view our favorite event on television. Some of us may have purchased tickets and be heading to Vancouver this upcoming winter. Others among us will follow the athlete who inspires us the most. Or some may monitor medal counts or watch the celebration of our Canadian culture within an Olympic framework. Regardless of what appeals to us about the Olympics, one thing cannot be taken for granted. The talented individuals at the center of this mega event will capture our attention. Either their elite performance or their personal stories will garner at least a segment of our imagination for 14 days in February and 10 days in March. The events, participants, and outcomes become part of sport history, but the personal connection to the cultural and sport exhibition of the Olympics and the Paralympics deepens many people's appreciation for the capabilities and expression of the human body. While we revel in the glory of athletes challenging the boundaries of sport, the Olympics bring together thousands of people to admire the feats of the human body and the technological advancements of science, art, engineering, and medicine. Regardless of achievement, each athlete will have devoted a significant period of his or her life to those few moments of Olympic glory. What inspires athletes to endure long hours of training, week after week, year after year? How does one get to a stage in sport participation and decide to commit several years of his or her life to an Olympic dream? Does the dream differ if you are male or female? Does the sport you participate in make a difference? All of these questions are equally valuable and sometimes difficult to respond to for both comparative and relational reasons. Not all athletes will win or even achieve their peak performance within the Olympic window, but the pursuit of the Olympic dream will have shaped their lives. For those successful enough to become an Olympian and Paralympian, the possibility of representing your country on the world stage in the host nation must be tremendous. With Coubertin's goal of the Olympic movement, quote, to contribute to building a peaceful and better world by educating youth and people through sport, end quote, the Olympic Games provides a celebration of culture and athletic prowess. The Olympic Games provide a landscape for cultural exchange, education, and sustainability initiatives. With legacies lasting beyond 24 days, the shared memories, economic commitments, and future opportunities coalesce to inspire young people invested in sport to strive for their Olympic moment. While not all young, competitive elite athletes can make an Olympic or Paralympic team, the desire and allure of the Olympic rings has attracted thousands of young people to sport. Athletes work at their sport for long hours. Week after week, year after year, they train and hone their skills to compete. Their bodies become vehicles to their dreams. They strengthen muscles, train their cardiovascular system, and master minute movements. At the same time, psychologically preparing to withstand vigorous workout routines and elite competition. Most of the time, the general public commonly think of these pursuits as positive, healthy behaviors. But what if we stop to question what this precludes? The devotion of hours to sport training must reduce the time spent doing other physical and social activities. Some elite competitors have educational schedules rearranged to facilitate optimal sport performance. Other athletes leave their family support system and relocate to access high-performance training centers, coaches, and support staff. While other families sacrifice time and money to ensure their son or daughter's central pursuit of an athletic dream is actualized. Given that many athletes build their careers from very young ages, issues of child labor can be called into question. According to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, a child means every human being below the age of 18 years unless under the law applicable to the child, majority is attained earlier. If athletes are devoting hours upon hours to a sport system that depends on their willingness to comply with regulated, normalized, and naturalized training routines and culture, athletes live very disciplined lives from a young age. Building friendships, learning about oneself outside of a world controlled by coaches, trainers, and therapists, and competitive schedules, to when where autonomy can be found, begs the question of considering athletes as child laborers. Elite specialized sport or high performance training establishes the athlete as the employee from which the sporting system operates. Coaches and other training professionals depend on athletes' performance. Therefore, the athlete supports others' livelihoods. Successful sport needs to attract spectators and future athletes to sustain its development. Consider the context of the upcoming Olympics. The funding structure for athlete development, the program development targeting young athletes, started well before the Olympics. Sport Canada would have commenced building a sports system for both support and development prior to the year Vancouver bid for the 2010 Games. The reality of producing a successful Olympic bid requires years of work in advance for both athletes and for members of the organizing committee. Expectations for our athletes. If we think about the system and the people involved, athletes become laborers. The athletic system is comprised of a team of highly trained and interconnected professionals working to mold human bodies into machines, peaking at just the right time to achieve optimal performance. While we appreciate the effort, determination, motivation, and aspirations of the athletes involved, unfortunately, effort is only part of the accomplishment. Results are key. Once awarded the Vancouver Games, the work of thousands of athletes, coaches, and support staff to achieve Olympic glory in their home country increases the drive for competition. But the pressure of performing also accompanies this thrill. One of the measures of success of the 21st Winter Olympiad will be assessed based on Canadian athletes' performance. Own the Podium, an initiative of Sport Canada, was designed to assist athletes in their quest for a stronger medal count in 2010. One of the disappointments of the 1988 Games in Calgary was the lack of gold medal performance by the host nation. While the infrastructure of the Calgary Games has helped to build sport in Canada, and the social impact of the Games claims to support sport and athlete development, medal performances at these Games were less than desirable. To be considered a top winter sporting nation, medals count. The Canadian government does not want to receive this type of negative publicity again, and given the amount of taxpayer dollars invested in bidding for and hosting the Olympics, the athletic system has supposedly changed to provide more successful and potential podium performances for our nation's athletes. The pursuit of an Olympic medal, or even participation on the world stage, is an incredible goal. The attraction is easy to understand. However, pausing to ask questions about the process is important. Are athletes' interests protected? Is there concern for the bodily welfare, the corporeality of living in a body under perpetual stress, and the repercussions of pushing a body to its maximal capacity and beyond? Is the well-being of athletes who withstand chronic pain acceptable? How far should athletes push the boundaries of sport? Is the health of an athlete beyond his or her competitive career a concern? What type of psychosocial development occurs when athletes' lives are invested in a body-dependent goal during formative years? With Canadians ranking sport participation as the second only to families as a highly positive influence in the lives of young people, these questions probably never filter into our collective. While not trying to belittle or discount the virtuous possibilities of sport to enable young people opportunities to gain and enhance a range of skills that will improve their development, the environment in which they participate will play a significant role. Athletes who have devoted thousands of hours to training often retire from their sport with bodies that are troubled by overuse injuries and chronic pain. Given the commitment invested in an Olympic dream, athletes train themselves to endure pain, to push their threshold so that they can strive for excellence. While providing child athletes as much agency as possible, the power relations involved in guiding athletes towards peak performance may indeed challenge more common sense practices. Rational questions about what is healthy for the overall growth and development, including the social and emotional aspects of childhood, may be neglected given the emphasis on athlete success. Minimizing risk for the athlete must be a central concern, but many people will determine how risk is defined differently. How often do the lines between athlete development and developing athletes become blurred? Earlier I asked a series of questions. I'd like to now revisit these. What inspires athletes to endure long hours of training week after week, year after year? How does a young athlete get to a stage of participation and decide to commit several years of his or her life to elite-level training? Does the sport you participate in make a difference? Does the Olympic dream differ if you are male or female? Does an athlete's gender really matter? Hosting the Olympic Games can positively impact sport participation and potentially the growth of physical activity opportunities for Canadians. While many positive benefits emerge from sport participation, not all people are in a position to receive these benefits. Social situations play a pivotal role in determining who has access to sport opportunities and who is accepted within sport environments. In particular, the Winter Olympics and Paralympics highlight social class, race, culture, and geographic location as paramount to the participation in the Olympic program events. While all of these social variables are important and intersect, I'm going to highlight the gender dynamics in sport. In Canada alone, if we focus on gendered participation in sport, it would seem the Olympics have played a pivotal role in shaping young women's sporting aspirations. Women's hockey made its inaugural appearance on the Olympic stage in 1998 in Nagano, Japan. In the year following the Nagano Olympics, there was a 30% increase in female hockey participation in this country. The growth of women's hockey continues to climb. In 2008, more than 74,000 women were registered with Hockey Canada, compared to approximately 8,000 registrants in 1990. While the Olympic dream may not be realistic for many of the women playing the game, one could argue that the possibility of participating in a sport receiving international attention has been influenced by the significance of women competing in the Olympic Games. Women were initially excluded from participating in the modern Olympic Games, and Coubertin may not have applied his famous phrase to the inclusion of equity policies in the name of the Olympics. However, for many, the phrase characterizing the Olympics applies. Quote, "The important thing in life is not the triumph, but the fight. The essential thing is not to have won, but to have fought well." End quote, Pierre de Coubertin. Today, in the year 2009, it seems the fight means more than athletic competition. A more recent case and ongoing event to watch as the 21st Winter Olympiad unfolds is the response to the exclusion of women's ski jumping. While the Olympic Charter includes parameters for the inclusion of new sports into the Games, the debate surrounding the rights of athletes who are working to develop, sustain, and advance their sport reminds us of the impact practices of inclusion and exclusion have for athletes and the general public's idea about sport. As I mentioned earlier, women were initially excluded from the modern Olympic Games. It was culturally unacceptable for women to take part in physically demanding activity. Female morphology was used to explain women's exclusion from sport. While this argument is used less frequently in contemporary settings, other measures of exclusion seem to arise. The most recent debate about gender parity in Olympic sport surrounds women's ski jumping. Ski jumping has been a component of the Winter Olympic Games since its inception in 1924. Females have been officially competing in ski jumping for 11 years, with demonstration events being held in 1998. Currently, Lindsey Vonn of the United States of America holds the record at the Olympic venue in Whistler. She has flown 90 meters, further than anyone else, male or female, but she will not be competing in the 21st Winter Olympiad. Currently, there are 146 women competing in the sport from 16 different countries. The average age of the top 20 athletes participating in the sport is 23 years old. The reasons for inclusion and exclusion of various sports have been manipulated throughout the history of the Olympics. The impact of including women's sport on the Olympic program is significant. Let's return to women's hockey. The evidence of the growth in participation numbers in the sport in a country that considers itself a hockey nation is tremendous. Imagine the opportunities that are presented to other young females in countries where the possibility of playing hockey is only beginning. Increasing sport opportunities for young people around the world is a goal of the Olympic movement. In today's context, this must include young women. The International Olympic Committee, the IOC, has put parameters in place to include and exclude sport in the Olympic program. But this is only part of the argument. It appears the IOC has complete control over the Games. While VANOC, the Vancouver Olympic Committee, is subject to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the BC Supreme Court found that the female skiers had suffered discrimination and the source of discrimination was the IOC. VANOC claims they are responsible for financing, organizing, and staging the Games, and the IOC is responsible for planning the program events to which VanOck is bound through the Olympic Charter. The act of violating the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is to be appealed by the skiers. Ironically, the IOC seems to be outside the reach of the Canadian court, yet federal, provincial, and municipal funds support and build the games. In the case of women's ski jumping, if the regulations of the Olympic Charter are beyond the host nation's court, who then besides the elite group of IOC members can hold the powerful group accountable to its own mandate? Let's consider the arguments. The technical merit of women's ski jumping exceeds some of the other sports which are already on the Olympic roster. The women's efforts to fight for their inclusion in the 2010 Olympics continues, and the IOC president, Jacques Rogge, claims that, quote, "The IOC is working hard to reach gender parity in winter and summer games. The reason we took the decision not to include women's ski jumping was made strictly on a technical basis and absolutely not on gender grounds, and was part of a process employed across all sport in the program," end quote. The female skiers petitioning the ruling are advised that ski jumping will be incorporated in the Youth Olympic Games, which will commence in Austria in 2012. I want to draw your attention to this supportive and conciliatory rationale. Not including the sport at the 21st Winter Olympiad is deemed to be understandable, given that the sport will be part of the Youth Olympic Games, in which athletes must be between 14 and 18 years old to compete. For many of the women currently participating at the top of their sport, this opportunity excludes their participation because they will be too old to compete in an Olympic-sponsored setting. The repercussion of continuing to limit the opportunities afforded to women in sport demonstrates the resistance female athletes encounter as they pursue their dreams, which are equal to men's, an Olympic dream. The IOC claims in its promotion of women in sport that all sports seeking inclusion in the games must include women's events. If gender parity is a paramount issue, perhaps ensuring sports which have international federation competitions that include women, and which have historically been excluded from the Olympic Forum, would be a necessary first step. A genuine investment in women's sporting success can be realized within the Olympic movement. When Vancouver 2010 arrives in February and March, many of the athletes we admire will no longer be under the age of 18 to be considered a child. But to achieve elite-level performances, many will have devoted their childhood to sport. Peter Donnelly, a professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Health at the University of Toronto, suggests that national team athletes are survivors rather than products of the system. Let's admire and support Olympic athletes, but let's not forget the countless hours these athletes commit to those few moments of Olympic glory. Watching the 21st Winter Olympiad, revel in the beauty of the highly trained athletic body. Consider the sacrifices that have been made to achieve this level of competition, the years devoted to honing a skill and training the body to achieve elite-level performance. Think also of who is included and accepted on the competitive world stage, and who is not.
Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010, UBC Continuing Studies in collaboration with universities across Canada, and The Globe and Mail.